From Ohio National Guard troops in Washington, D.C., to a summer crime spike in Cincinnati and a battle over a Hyde Park Square redevelopment plan, it's been a busy 2025. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our Friday news review, the biggest stories of the year and a look at what's next. Joining me first is Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Welcome back, Karen.
Hey, great to be here.
It's always great to have you. We've got a gubernatorial race coming up in Ohio next year, and the big kind of elephant in the room is who will Governor Mike DeWine endorse, if anybody? What has he said about that?
Well, the race is really interesting because, first of all, we do have two people who've never held elected office before who are both vying to be governor, and that's Vivek Ramaswamy, the tech billionaire from the Cincinnati area, who is the likely Republican candidate. There is another entrant in that race, but Ramaswamy's been campaigning since February and has the endorsement of President Trump, as well as most Republicans in the state in terms of office holders. And then Amy Acton, the former director of the Ohio Department of Health under Governor Mike DeWine, she's the likely Democratic nominee. So DeWine is looking at this race both saying that he fully expects to endorse the Republican nominee, though he has not said he will endorse Vivek Ramaswamy, but also his former health director is running. So it's an interesting race for him, I think, to look at.
Yeah. What kind of position does that put him in? Is that sort of awkward for the governor?
Well, my colleague Sarah Donaldson at a breakfast that DeWine held for State House reporters earlier this month, she asked him directly, why haven't you endorsed Vivek Ramaswamy yet? And he said, well, he's been meeting with him, been talking to him. And I think it's been pretty clear that Ramaswamy has made some statements on social media that maybe DeWine might have some issue with. Some of the things that he said that he wants to do, Ramaswamy has said he wants to do, DeWine's already done, such as the science of reading and things like that. But also, there's some questions, I think, how in line DeWine and Ramaswamy are in terms of vision. And DeWine says he wants to talk to him, is meeting with him, wants to share his vision as well as hear Ramaswamy's vision. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens there.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Dr. Amy Acton. Have her chances improved? I mean, this has been becoming a more and more ruby red kind of state in Ohio.
Absolutely. And that's really, that goes back to the 90s in terms of Ohio being a red state. I mean, there were a couple of years, you know, Barack Obama won Ohio twice. That's true. But when you're talking about statewide elections, since 1994, 82% of statewide elections with candidates have been won by the Republican candidate. So Acton really has a big hill to climb here. But polling is suggesting that she does have a chance. And of course, it's a midterm year coming up next year. So the party that is not in control of the White House and also is not in control of Congress or the Senate is expected to do well. At least that's what conventional wisdom would have. But there was a poll from Emerson College, which got the polling absolutely right in 2024 in Ohio, that suggests that Acton and Ramaswamy are pretty much neck and neck. And one of the things that stands out to me when I look at this poll is the negatives for Ramaswamy versus Acton. Ramaswamy has a higher unfavorability rating than Acton does. And that's something that he would have to overcome. But, you know, we got a long way to go. It's less than a year, but it's still a long way to go before we are voting on governor.
Yeah. Well, and Ohio also has a U.S. Senate race next year. I know Senator John Husted has already filed to run to keep his seat. Is there any doubt that Sherrod Brown will file to run to try to get that seat away from him?
Oh, no doubt that he's going to run. I mean, my colleagues, Sarah Donaldson and Joe Ingles, have talked to both the candidates. Sarah talked to Husted. Joe talked to Sherrod Brown. And that's going to be the race. I don't think that there's really any candidates that have filed to run against them for the primary, because we do have a primary coming up in May. But the races in both the governor's race and the U.S. Senate race look like they're pretty well set, but they may not.
Do you think Sherrod Brown's decision to run for Senate instead of governor disappointed any Democrats? I mean, he has held elected office before. He's done well statewide in the past. Did we lose you, Karen?
We're trying to return to the Senate. And, you know, you've got a candidate in John Husted, who has not run for that office. This will be his first election to that office since he was appointed earlier this year. So it's going to be an expensive race, and it could get kind of ugly.
Yeah. Do you think Sherrod Brown's decision to run for Senate instead of governor disappointed any Democrats? I mean, he has been elected statewide before.
Well, I think that there was some disappointment among union members who were really hoping to see Sherrod Brown run for governor, but he pretty much made his decision. And, you know, the governor's race was really kind of wacky for a little while in terms of who was going to run and who was not going to run. I think, you know, Acton and Ramaswamy both came out very early in the year saying that they were going to seek their party's nominations. But then there were these questions about whether Democratic former Congressman Tim Ryan would run, and he didn't make that decision until late in the year. And then,
and I think we've lost Karen again. Karen, can you hear me? Okay, Karen, I'm not sure you can hear me. Something's interfering with our signal here. I've been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Thanks so much for your time today, Karen. Sorry about our technical problems there. We'll talk more, or we'll talk about immigration after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. Cincinnati's summer crime spike dominated headlines for months, along with the story of a local religious leader detained by ICE before ultimately regaining his freedom. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss some of Greater Cincinnati's biggest news stories of 2025 are WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and general assignment reporter Nick Swartzel. Welcome back, Becca and Nick.
Thanks, Lucy.
Hey, Lucy.
Great to have you both in the studio. We really appreciate it. Becca, I want to start with you. As I said, this spike in crime was dominating the headlines for quite a while over this past year. Remind us briefly what the data showed about crime and some of the ways the city responded to that.
Well, I think it's important to note that overall, crime in Cincinnati started out down in 2025, and it was trending down for the city at large throughout the year. However, there were some pretty significant spikes, as you said, concentrated in certain areas, particularly over the Rhine and downtown. Now, there were some pretty high-profile incidents that were especially horrific, including the murder of a local gym owner in over the Rhine in his own home, a couple of other things similar to that that were violent crime. However, most of the spike in crime was actually property crime. So we're thinking burglary, part one. We're thinking theft from auto and auto theft are kind of the two main categories of crime that were up significantly. Now, as I said, overall, and we'll maybe talk about this a little later, crime is down when you look at the numbers for the city as a whole. But that's also not a particularly useful number to look at if you're thinking, you know, am I a resident of one of these areas or wanting to visit one of these areas? It's really more useful to look at kind of the specific areas that we're talking about here. And for the most part, the increases we were seeing over the summer were in over the Rhine and the Central Business District.
And the city, tell us again how the city responded to those areas, those increases.
It was kind of a range. We saw a few waves of responses. In particular, the big fight that went viral on social media. I believe that was in July. But that was kind of the biggest wave of responses from city officials. We saw things ranging from additional foot patrols, bike patrols, established somewhat more recently, putting the SWAT team on Fountain Square every night. There was an increased curfew or an earlier curfew for minors, unaccompanied minors, or unsupervised minors in especially downtown, although the city council did also revise the citywide curfew for minors, which is 11 p.m., but a much earlier curfew for certain parts of the city. There was a street crimes task force that was established over the summer that was focusing not necessarily in a geographic area, but it was kind of a roving task force. So this was an initiative that was put forward to kind of focus on looking at the really immediate crime data and say, okay, what is an issue that we're looking at? Theft from auto and auto theft, it was kind of dominating, as I said. So looking at a particular issue and then following where those crimes are kind of spiking throughout the city and responding to them there. Mm-hmm. So those are some examples of things that were also the city manager did some kind of administrative things. such as for a while, starting in September, prohibiting food trucks from operating after 11 p.m. on weekend nights in, again, that kind of over the Rhine and downtown area. Those were actually just recently lifted, although I don't know how much food trucks are operating late at night in the very cold. Some other restrictions on things like red bike operation. I could probably go on, but it's a wide range, and these happen in waves. So, you know, when, a wave of things after a certain incident, a wave of other things after another incident, just kind of responding as things come up.
Well, I know the mayor acknowledged that the way people feel about crime is extremely important. Tell us more about why he spoke out about that as these, you know, headlines as this news continued.
Yeah, this was a bit of a change in messaging on the part of the city, especially Mayor Aftab Pureval. So, you know, as I said, if you look at numbers citywide, crime is down. It was down at the beginning of the year. It's down at the end of the year. But that is something that Mayor Pureval and other officials did say as a way to kind of, the intention, I think, was to reassure people that the data shows that crime is down. I think the messaging change there reflects that in many ways, it doesn't really matter what the data shows. People's perceptions of crime are shaped by their experiences and often by the media as well. And we all know how much media attention, the fight downtown especially got. And that especially when it comes to downtown and over the Rhine, which are really the city's primary centers for visitors who don't live in the city coming in to spend money and, you know, generate tax revenue for sales tax revenue for the city. That in particular, you know, people aren't looking at the data before they come down. They're looking at the news before Sure. they decide whether to visit. But also for folks who live in the city, I think perception of safety has an effect on mental health and your sense of security and safety in the city, just as much as the reality of crime in many ways.
If you've been a victim of crime.
Or know someone who's been a victim of crime. So in that ways, I think Mayor Pureval and others kind of moved away from this data approach and really emphasized many, many times that the focus is also on perception of safety, not just on the data. Mm-hmm. But I will say, again, the early messages were about the fact that crime is down citywide, but there were spikes. There were significant spikes in both primarily in property crime, but some in violent crime as well in parts of the city.
Yeah. Well, City Manager Cheryl Long ultimately asked Police Chief Teresa Thiege to resign, then put the chief on administrative leave. Where does that whole process stand?
So the city ended up hiring a law firm to conduct, it was initially deemed an internal investigation, but now this law firm has been contracted to conduct this investigation. It's Frost Brown Todd. The contract with the city is up to $40,000 total. And it covers a range of questions that the city basically asked the law firm to look at. So things like, has Thiege been an effective leader and manager of the police department, including personnel and resources, et cetera, et cetera. The contract is effective through December 31st. Now, I did ask for an update if there's any chance. Obviously, what's today, the 18th, 19th? We're getting pretty close to that, and I expect there may not be as much work going on over the holidays, but it's unclear if that report will be completed by then. I did ask the city if there was any chance of extending that contract if the work is taking longer than anticipated. So far, it seems like that's not being discussed. And even once the report is delivered to the city, it's unclear, you know, whether that will be released publicly immediately or if there will be some kind of more internal work that will be done before that report is released. So, you know, it could be before the end of the year we get an answer on what that investigation uncovered and what the city manager decides to do with that information. It also may be early next year before we know.
Okay. Do we have any way of knowing? You were talking about all these different measures the city took to try to address this spike in crime and the concerns that, you know, residents and visitors had over the summer. Do we have any way of knowing whether that response from city leaders has had made a measurable difference in crime this year?
So we can look at where the crime rates stand right now. Obviously, we're not totally through the year yet, but the information posted online goes through, let me look at this to make sure I'm saying the right date, goes through December 13th, so about a week ago. What's difficult to determine, or really impossible to determine, is, you know, what measures contributed to the change in crime rates, right? You know, especially if we're looking at a citywide number. So it's difficult to say, yes, the measures reflected this. Now, there is always a bit of a spike in summer crime. If you think about it, the warm weather is just more conducive to many types of criminal activity. So it's normal for crime to spike in the summer and then go down as the months get colder. So some of the decrease we've seen in recent months would have happened anyway based on historic trends. I can say, though, that looking at those latest numbers again through December 13th, citywide, we're ending the year where violent crime is 7.5% lower than it was at this time last year, and a little less than 7% lower than the three-year average. Now, I mentioned most of the spike was related to property crime, but even in those categories, again, looking at the citywide number, it is about 2.5% lower than last year and almost 5% lower than the three-year average. Hmm. But looking at the specific neighborhoods where we were seeing those increases, it's a little bit of a different story. So in the Central Business District, which includes the riverfront, I think the banks and downtown, Part 1 violent crime is up about 36% compared to the three-year average and almost 8% compared to last year. And then property crime, we're seeing much more significant increases there, almost 32% compared to the three-year average and about 21% compared to last year. Over the Rhine is a little bit different. We're seeing very similar increases in property crime. But when it comes to violent crime, it's down almost 4% compared to the three-year average and about 4% compared to last year. So that's a lot of numbers. It's difficult to kind of keep track of all that in your mind. I guess the main headline is all types of crime are down citywide. The biggest increases when you look at the year as a whole continue to be in property crime, not in violent crime. And even in those areas where we had those significant increases over the summer, that's definitely cooled down quite a bit at the end of the year.
Okay. Well, we appreciate that update. I want to turn to you, Nick. Here in Cincinnati, a major case this year was the detention of Ayman Salomon. Remind us of what happened with him.
Sure. Salomon was a journalist in Egypt. He's been in the United States for about a decade, but before that, he covered the Arab Spring kind of uprising in Egypt. And he says because of that, was persecuted by the Egyptian government, detained a number of times, even physically abused. He came to the United States in 2014 and got asylum in 2018. And he kind of tried to build a life here, doing a lot of work with his Muslim faith and you know, with other community groups. In the final days of the Biden administration, December last year, he got notice that his asylum was in the process of being revoked due to claims about his ties to a nonprofit that might have had ties to the Muslim Brotherhood. By June 2025, after Trump came into office, his asylum was officially revoked, and then the next month in July, he was arrested at an ICE appointment. He spent about 73 days in Butler County Jail before being released in September, and now he's trying to kind of build his life back, go back to whatever normal is at that point. Yeah.
Well, and ultimately, he was released, like unlike a lot of other detainees. Why? Why do you think he was released?
So the U.S. attorneys who worked this case and other, you know, sort of federal authorities aren't saying a whole lot, but there were some errors in their case related to the ties between the nonprofit that he worked for and the Muslim Brotherhood. There are also a lot of questions about whether the Muslim Brotherhood should even be considered. They're not considered a terrorist organization in the United States, although some people would like to. So there's questions. There's like very murky ties at all to anything, you know, threatening. But then on top of that, there were some added allegations later that he was wanted for murder in Iraq. That was later revealed to be some kind of paperwork error on U.S. attorney's part. So the case was just falling apart, basically, it seems like. And while the U.S. attorneys won't say exactly why they dropped it, it was just completely dropped, which is unusual.
Yeah. Do you think his case has any broader implications?
I think there are a couple of interesting things about it. One thing I think is that we've seen a lot of talk about the Trump administration being very defiant in the face of the legal system when it comes to immigration, basically like doing whatever they need to deport people. And in this case, the legal system seems to have worked. It would seem like this this deportation was stopped, and his asylum was restored. I think it also kind of shows that it seems like in the past, when you think about U.S. attorneys, they usually bring very strong cases. Very unlikely that you're going to see many errors. And for whatever reason, this case had some errors in it. And so take what you will from that in terms of how that office is operating.
Hmm. Well, Nick, I know you've also talked with other people seeking asylum who could be facing removal from the U.S. What are you seeing in those communities?
Yeah, I've spent some time over the past couple of years talking to folks who are connected to or part of the Senegalese and Mauritanian communities. They generally are north of Cincinnati and in places like Lockland and Forest Park. And when Trump first came into office, I spoke to a bunch of those folks who I had interviewed before, and they said, hey, we're not really that worried. We're seeking asylum. We have pretty good asylum claims. But as things have worn on, the anxiety has gotten a lot higher. And I've spoken to a couple immigration attorneys who represent these folks, and they say that the process for them is really tough. And people are either being removed or very worried about being removed. I spoke to one man from Senegal who was in the Butler County Jail in the middle of removal proceedings. And he also had some things to say about the conditions there. There was a story about that earlier this year where he was basically like, go ahead and send me back if this is what it's going to be like. I need medical attention. I need things like that. So there's a lot of fear. One of the attorneys I talked to and one of the folks who was facing kind of like his asylum process rolling forward, they were telling me that it really depends on how much means a person has if they're coming from a country like Mauritania or Senegal, and sort of their level of education. The more you, if you have an advanced degree, if you've documented your claim really well, if you have the money to put into the process, you face a much better chance. And a lot of folks from Mauritania or Senegal don't have those things, and so it's a tough process for them. Mm-hmm.
Well, related to these issues with immigration, more recently, an ICE official here in Cincinnati was arrested on assault, domestic violence, and strangulation charges. What's the latest in that case? And do you think there are broader lessons that we'll learn from that?
Sure. Yeah. So just to refresh people who maybe haven't heard of this or don't remember, earlier this month, Samuel Saxon was arrested December 5th, December 6th, the morning, the evening and morning of those days, for allegedly putting his domestic partner in a chokehold, and was later arraigned on those charges. At that arraignment, Hamilton County prosecutors alleged he has a long history of this across multiple states. So recently, this week, he was also placed on a federal detainer and indicted on a federal charge of lying to another Department of Homeland Security officer. He was moved from the Hamilton County Justice Center to the Butler County Jail on a federal detainer, and he faces a hearing in that matter December 22nd at the federal courthouse. Mm-hmm. So that's in addition to the charges of strangulation, domestic violence, and felonious assault that he's facing as well.
Do you think there are broader lessons to be learned from his case?
I think we'll have to see how it plays out. I think that it will be an interesting trial on these charges. We don't often see a law enforcement professional tried for these things, especially a federal one. So we'll see how that goes. And if the evidence is overwhelming, how he's held accountable.
Yeah. Okay, Nick. Well, you've also done extensive reporting on housing in Cincinnati this year. I know you and Becca teamed up on some of that, but I'm going to direct these questions to you. What's the latest with Victory Vistas in Paddock Hills? I know tenants in this building owned by Chinnan and Dukwe are facing steep rent increases, aren't they?
Yeah, so a little backstory here. Victory Vistas, it's 50 units, brand new apartment building, opened last year, and it was constructed, Kingsley & Company, which is owned by Chinnan and Dukwe, they built it using federal low-income housing tax credits. Now, what those do is they restrict the amount of rent you can charge to keep the building affordable. The way Victory Vistas is set up, 10 of the units in the building are for very low-income people making 30% of area median income. So you think about like $600 a month for a one-bedroom apartment, right? The rest are at 60% AMI. So let's just say like around $1,200 a month for a one-bedroom. So what happened is, we think, is that more of those units than the 10 were rented at the 30% AMI level. And Kingsley claims that that was because the property manager at the time made a mistake. Residents there contest that. They say the property manager says that's not the case, but that's not, you know, I don't want to get into that.
Yeah.
This fall, about a dozen people there who were at the 30% AMI level got noticed like, hey, you're going to have to pay much more in rent. You know, you're going from that roughly $600 level to that roughly $1,200 level. Now, these are folks who are seniors. They're on fixed incomes. Some of them have like mobility issues or other health issues. This is a big deal for them, they say. And they obviously say they can't pay that. And so they sought legal help. They got help from legal aid, and legal aid is saying like, hey, you know, you really can't do this. This is basically like you're not renewing their leases without cause. Mm. And there was a big sort of uproar about it. And even at City Hall, the tenants came before City Hall and said like, hey, this is our, you know, we're having a problem here. And the mayor made some pretty like strong statements like this isn't acceptable. Council members also were saying like, yeah, we can't let this happen. And since then, Kingsley has come out and said like, hey, we're going to cover Kingsley and a nonprofit they work with at this development called SOACT. We're going to cover the rent until March 1st. And we're also working on some long-term solutions. And that's kind of where things stand right now.
Well, I know there was a complaint that went before the Ohio Housing Finance Agency about whether they could even, whether they had the ability or the authority or, you know, whether it was okay for them to double the rent like this. What did that come, how did that work out?
Yeah, so the Ohio Housing Finance Agency administers these low-income housing tax credits for the federal government. So they're kind of like making sure the rules are getting followed. They're awarding the credits in the first place. And they said as long as there are 10 units at that 30% AMI level, still, which Kingsley says there are, even after the rent increases, then they're following the rules. Hmm. And so, you know, this seems on the face of it to be within the rules that HUD has set for these credits. I think Legal Aid has some things to say about that in terms of, well, you know, you still can't not renew somebody's lease, and that's what they're claiming this rent increase is. I don't think that this is the end-all be-all, but I think, you know, the question about the tax credits is, you know, OFA has weighed in on that.
Yeah. Well, and Nick, we're running out of time, but you've been covering lots of other stories related to housing conditions, tenants' rights. What's next for your coverage?
Looking into some other large landlords and some things that they're doing, following the coming indictment, we think, of the co-founder of a group you've probably heard about if you listen to WVXU Vision and Beyond. That should be coming early next year. And Yeah.
Plenty of work to do. And Becca, I know you have an interview coming up with Councilmember-elect Ryan James. That's coming up next week too, right?
Yes, on Monday. You can tune in and hear that and read it on WVXU.org as well.
Okay. And we're going to be talking with Councilmember James in January on this program. Well, you two have been great. There's lots of big news that we weren't able to talk about, but check out WVXU.org and search their bylines. You'll see it all. I've been talking with WVXU General Assignment Reporter Nick Swartzel and Local Government Reporter Becca Costello. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, the mysterious resignation of Kroger's CEO and other big business stories of 2025. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Our news partners at the Cincinnati Business Courier focus all year on the companies, developments, and big ideas that fuel our region's economy. So let's tap into their big business brains. Joining me in this recorded interview to discuss some of their paper's biggest stories of 2025 are Business Courier editor Tom Demaropoulos and managing editor Andy Brownfield. Welcome back, Tom and Andy.
Happy to be here, Lucy. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Great to have you. So let's start with Kroger. Big shakeup earlier this year with the resignation of former CEO Rodney McMullen. Has there been any more information about the reason behind that?
That is a question that I think I get every time I'm out in the community is what happened with Rodney? As far as we know, nothing has come out on that.
Okay.
It actually was brought up in a lawsuit against Kroger, whether it was pertinent to, I believe, the failed merger between Kroger and Albertsons. And a Hamilton County judge requested, or no, not requested, compelled Rodney to disclose the reason why he's no longer with Kroger to see if it was relevant to the case, and determined it was not. So that does remain sealed.
Okay. Well, how close is the company to hiring a new CEO?
So from our most recent report, it sounds like Kroger will be looking to hire a new CEO early in 2026, potentially even in January. We could get an announcement on who will be leading or the nation's largest traditional grocer going forward.
Mm. Yeah, and as part of that, it was released as part of the third quarter earnings call. Ron Sargent, the interim CEO, said that the announcement would be made in the first quarter of 2026. There's some confusion, some wiggle room there, because is it the first calendar quarter or is it the first fiscal quarter? Kroger's fiscal quarter, I believe, doesn't start until a couple months after the calendar year.
Oh, so tricky. Well, Kroger has also had some big layoffs and delivery changes. Can you walk us through that quickly?
Yeah, so Kroger announced in August that it was going to be cutting 1,000 corporate administrative positions. So these aren't frontline workers, not the people you're going to see in the stores, but rather the kind of people who work in their downtown headquarters, their Blue Ash Digital Building, 8451, their marketing data arm. And only two of those job cuts are coming from Cincinnati. The rest of them are from outside the region.
Okay. And what about those delivery changes?
Yeah, so that's been a big storyline kind of throughout the year for Kroger's as they've kind of, it sounds like, again, Ron Sargent has kind of done a full analysis of what the company is doing in terms of their delivery strategy. And they have decided that, it's kind of best to work with these partners instead of going through the mega fulfillment centers with Ocado. They've, worked with DoorDash and all the other kind of delivery agencies to up that investment and kind of pull back on some of the Ocado delivery program that they had previously used. And they're going to take a pretty good size hit because of that change. I think it was a $2.6 billion charge.
Yeah, $2.6 billion in its third quarter, which just ended. And $350 million is going to close three of those fulfillment centers. Now, this is a big swing for Kroger. They were really betting that they'd have these hub and spoke distribution centers where they'd fill orders and then send them out directly to customers. It looks like they found it more efficient to have these third-party delivery partners like Uber Eats and DoorDash get these items directly from the stores instead of these warehouses and ship them right to customers.
Okay. Well, the next big story we want to talk about is the banks. The Bengals and Hamilton County finally reached a deal on renovating Paycor Stadium. Remind us what that ended up being.
Yes. So this is kind of this was something that we were covering all year this year. And in the summer, the team and the county agreed to an extension. We're going to keep the Bengals for at least another 8 years, I believe. And we're going to see an investment into the stadium of $470 million. So it's going to get a very large upgrade. But also, it's, some money coming from the Bengals. $120 million will be paid for by the team, and the other $350 will come from the county. That's an improvement from the previous deal because it puts skin in the game from the team. Mm.
And it also gets rid of like the so-called hologram clause, where if a majority of other NFL stadiums had invested in some brand new G-Wiz technology like a hologram, then the county would be on the hook for making sure that the Paycor Stadium also had that technology. And the Hamilton County Commissioners are counting that as a win, despite the fact that taxpayers are on the hook for so much of this new Paycor Stadium upgrades.
Well, the Riverfront site is also being discussed again as a location for a new arena, right where the existing arena is. Tell us about that.
Yes. Yeah, so this was an update on kind of some stories we had been working on last year where, there's Cincinnati, it is believed that we need a new arena. So where do you put the new arena? That's been kind of the big question. And at one point in time, the kind of current site had been removed from contention, and some people got together, including MSA architects, and kind of looked at like how can we relay out that site to make a new arena work there. And they believe they've got a workable plan, and now it is kind of back on the drawing board as an option.
And it's going to require kind of a dramatic overhaul because back when the arena was built, the banks had not yet been engineered in such a way that the flood wall was there to prevent the Ohio River from encroaching. Because I remember being a kid and half the time, when the river was high, the banks, where the banks is now, which was for all intents and purposes, a parking lot would be flooded. So the Heritage Bank Arena was built with that in mind. So it's actually significantly above where neighboring Great American Ballpark is. So the idea here would be moving some streets, lowering that back down so it's in line with Great American Ballpark, extending the flood wall eastward, eliminating the public landing, which is right now is essentially a parking lot, and then realigning 2nd Street East Pete Rose Way and its intersection with Broadway to open up more space to the north. And that would actually expand the Heritage Bank Arena site from 4.1 acres to about 6 1/3.
Well, what about this big plan to finish the banks? I mean, there are still lots of empty lots down there between Paycor Stadium and Great American Ballpark. What could go there and how much could it cost?
That's a great question, is what could go there? I think we're going to see more residential development, more commercial development. And honestly, I think this is the city's chance to go dense, to go big, to have some tall buildings, to really activate the entirety of the banks. It's going to take a lot of people. And that means residents, that means things that draw people down there on a regular basis, and potentially, office space, maybe a hotel, another hotel definitely would be a thing that would get people down there. So, it would be a very large investment because you're talking about completing not just the spaces where they are kind of pad ready, where the garage has already been built under, like lot 24, which is just south of the Taste of Belgium and where GE at the banks was, but finishing the garages under kind of those other parcels that aren't ready yet. So there'd be some more investment on kind of the county and city side, and then hopefully some developers that would want to invest down there as well.
And we started off this talking about the banks with the Bengals Paycor Stadium lease renewal. Earlier this year, the banks put out a request for proposals for some of these remaining lots, especially lot 24. And they had gotten some ideas from some architects and developers, but that was put on pause because they wanted to complete this lease renewal first, because they were kind of limited with what they could build there in terms of height by restrictions in the Bengals lease. So with the renegotiation, that now allows them to build high. So like, for instance, there are two 24-story residential towers that are being proposed here. Among many other things, the plan contemplates 860 to a little more than 1,200 new housing units and up to 150 hotel rooms. And the plan as presented would cost about $800 million, and that's with government subsidy.
Does that include what the governments would have to pay to do those foundations, that garage supportive structure that's needed on some of those lots?
That does not, I don't believe. I think that's going to cost tens of millions of dollars more to kind of prepare the land for development on top of it.
Yeah. Well, there's a long way to go before the banks gets finished. We know that. But we're getting closer on the downtown convention center renovation.
Yes. January, I believe January 21st is the kind of grand opening where they'll be revealing the new expanded, renovated convention center, which I don't know. Have you been down to the plaza yet?
Yes.
This looks so great. It is, especially with the ice rink right now. I love it.
And close to my heart, one of the first events there is going to be the U.S. Fencing Association's North American Cup. It's an annual tournament. So it's kind of qualifiers for the bigger tournaments in fencing. I'm an amateur fencer myself, and I remember going last year not to compete, but just to watch some high-level fencing. These people would mop the floor with me.
Andy, you have that dangerous look about you. Now I understand why. So what's going on with the new convention headquarters hotel?
Yeah, so that's, a massive project that is, when you look at kind of the landscape of downtown and you think about the most critical pieces, it's hard to remember that we have not had a headquarters hotel for a while. And bringing that back, getting construction started in 2026 on that project is going to be a true multiplier, because it's not just people who work downtown or residents that live there. It's bringing fresh dollars back into the city, and having that headquarters hotel again is going to help really drive the ability to sell Cincinnati for conventions, bring hundreds and hundreds of people down to the region who have fresh wallets every week when they come in. That's great for the restaurants. It's great for retailers. It's great for the hotels. So that is truly going to be a huge impact on Cincinnati once that gets going.
And there were some pretty big developments in that front this year. We learned that A, Portman Holdings, the developer behind the hotel, was going to buy a second separate hotel and scale down their plans for the number of rooms. We learned that it was going to be a Marriott hotel. I think it's Cincinnati's first pure Marriott, not one of their sub-brands. And it's scheduled right now to cost about $536 million and open in June of 2028. And the city is establishing a new community authority to help with the construction of that, where, you know, restaurants in that district are going to opt in, but then there's going to be a 1% charge on food, which is going to raise about $1.1 million annually to fuel the construction of the hotel.
Mm-hmm. Well, the new Salazar restaurant is right in that neck of the woods, and it already opened. How important is that to that whole area?
I think it's another, you know, another critical cog that we need to connect the Fountain Square District all the way up to the convention center and make that a true corridor of activity that goes all the way from the convention center down to Fifth Third's headquarters and beyond.
Mm-hmm. And Salazar, he's just one of the biggest names in food in Cincinnati. And his original flagship restaurant in Over the Rhine, it was very well regarded, highly renowned. I mean, Salazar himself was a multi-James Beard Award nominee chef, and he only had 42 seats at that first restaurant. So he's got 220 in this new one. And it's really going to create a draw, a destination for people to be in that Fountain District. The Convention District, which connects to the Fountain District, which connects to Court Street, which connects to Over the Rhine. So it really helps, what Tom was saying, with creating more of a cohesive downtown destination.
Well, another redevelopment that's made big headlines this year, Hyde Park Square. What's the latest with that project?
Well, okay. So, you know, there's a big kerfluffle earlier this year about it's just too big. The neighborhood council, the group Save Hyde Park Square, very, very vocal, very active group, really balked at the idea that it was going to be 85 feet tall. I mean, the LA's building neighboring this proposed development is only 62 feet tall. So after it was passed, the zoning change by city council, Save Hyde Park Square got an very large number of signatures in order to put that on the ballot, which ultimately killed the project as planned. But just this month, the developers, along with MSA Design, they reconvened with the neighborhood council and they presented two new options, one which would include 135 apartments, another would have 80 apartments plus a hotel. And these are, while not in line with the 62-foot LA's building, they're significantly smaller than the 85 feet originally proposed. They're going to be about 70, 75, 73. The developers asked the Hyde Park Neighborhood Council to vote on which one they would prefer, but they said at the time they just weren't ready to do that yet.
And what does this say about just the impact of community councils and communities on this kind of development?
Yeah, so Lucy, I was going to say, I think what this kind of says is that, there was the idea that elections have consequences and that leading up to the election, would some people who had voted for this initially were they at risk? And that was kind of the idea that some council members might lose their seat because of their vote on this. And that didn't happen. The council was reelected kind of going away. It wasn't even really close. So now I would imagine that some council members view this as there's a need for more housing and their voters have told them, go for it. Build dense, build large housing. So we'll kind of see where this plan goes from here.
Yeah. Well, let's end on a sweet note. Ice cream. What's the big news with UDF this year?
So actually, a couple of our iconic ice cream ice cream companies have made big changes this year. UDF has its first new CEO in decades, and it's the first time somebody with the last name of Lindner is not going to be leading the company. They brought on Michael Ahmed, the chief operating officer formerly of Gorilla Glue, and he actually sat down with our reporter Christian LeDuc to talk about his plans. And right now, he seems to be in more of a waiting and learning phase. He's working all the different jobs as a good CEO should, from retail up to kind of learn the business. But they're going to lean into some of the things that they've been experimenting with a couple years ago. They brought donut production in-house. They have more grab-and-go items, what they call food innovation. They're going to lean into that, as well as, hey, we had a great cover story earlier about with Wawa and Sheetz and Bucky's encroaching on UDF's territory, these kind of better convenience store brands. What's UDF going to do in reaction? And in a lot of instances, they are demolishing and rebuilding some of their stores on these key corners just to kind of up the experience for customers. And under their new CEO, that's going to continue as well.
And there's news with Grainers, too. Grainers announced it would become partially employee-owned. How's that happening?
Yeah, so Grainers is going to go the route of an employee stock ownership plan or an ESOP. So that will give employees the opportunity to share in the profits and ownership of this iconic Cincinnati company. I believe, Andy, you interviewed Rich Grainer, right? You talked to Rich about this plan. And it was really interesting to hear his take on why they decided to go this route, and that they had the opportunity for kind of a private equity. But they're like, no, we want to keep this, we want to keep the Cincinnati owned. We want to keep this with our employees. Just an interesting decision that probably was not the most lucrative, but in their mind was the best decision for the company.
Yeah, like many companies, organizations, they have a mandatory retirement age. You can't work at Grainers past 70. So as the latest generation of employee or family owners are approaching that age, they had to figure out how to buy out their shares. And they could, like Tom said, they could have gone private equity, they could have sold the company. But instead, in order to keep their own people invested, to retain and attract and keep on board the top talent, they decided to hand over ownership to their employees. So about 44% of the company's stock is in the ESOP trust. So the Grainer family still maintains majority control of the company, but it does really put skin in the game for the people who are working for Grainers.
Controversial question for you both. Favorite UDF flavor, favorite Grainers flavor? Tom, you go first.
Favorite UDF flavor is peanut butter chip, and that might be my favorite overall ice cream flavor. I know. Favorite Grainers flavor, black raspberry chip. That's a classic.
So for UDF, I'm going to have to go with the birthday cake. It's a little over the top, a little very rich, but I love it. And then for Grainers, I've just always been a huge fan of their mint chocolate chip with the giant chocolate chunks.
Okay. Well, strong choices there from our strong guests. I've been talking with Cincinnati Business Courier editor Tom Demaropoulos and managing editor Andy Brownfield. Thank you both so much for your time and your insights.
Thanks, Lucy. Happy to be here.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.